This is Offstage and On the Air, performance number 654. My name is Lisa Sheps. I am joined through the magic of the telephone, my co-host, Miss Nicole Shiro.
Hello!
You're listening to us on KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. We stream this live every Wednesday at koop.org. Don't go away.
Step right up, the show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cup. Step right up, feast your eyes on the wonders of this world. Oh yeah.
But the cold clear world of the intellect is the world that I revere. In the pure dry air of the scientist, I am in my proper sphere to illumine what was dark with a spark of cerebral electricity.
It is Wednesday, February 22nd, 2022. That's 2222. It is also Groundhog Day. On the show today, we will have our second part of our Vortex story about long-standing theater series. And of course, we have lively discussions of the world of theater in Austin, New York, Chicago, Fargo, North Dakota, and places north. Don't go away.
The power of the mind to find what a foe has concealed with devilish care. There's joy. There's happiness.
There's joy and happiness in Mudville.
Who was that?
Who was that?
You know, because I was enjoying him very, very much.
Yes, I do, but I can't remember. Fritz Weaver.
I don't know, but that was delightful.
It's Fritz Weaver. Singing clear.
Fritz made me smile.
Singing Clear Cold World from Baker Street.
Don't know it, but it made me happy.
Well, it's a street in London.
I know Baker Street. I just don't know that.
I don't know the show either, but that was the 2006 recording.
Oh, wow.
In case you were curious.
Yeah, I thought it was way older. So
yeah, no, it does have that old sound to it. I believe it is a
very, very, very old sound by Fritz.
It does. Well, I would like to thank Kim Simpson for another wonderful International Folk Bazaar.
Kim is always bizarre-y folking it up.
Especially, I liked, oh my God, I forgot the, oh darn, the very famous folk singer who sang Groundhog, which was a very interesting song about somebody catching and cooking a groundhog and then eating it. And here's something I'd like to say about groundhogs. May I riff on groundhogs for a second?
Go right ahead.
Hogs are always on the ground. So why is the groundhog a special kind of hog?
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, you think that was just rhetorical, but I just don't understand. So it is Groundhog Day. It is 2222222.
There's lots. I know. That's like crazy. I was like, whoa, today is 2222222.
It is crazy. And it is the day before the 2022 version of Snowpocalypse here in Austin, Texas. So those of us here in Austin, not talking about our international listeners or our listeners across the nation, but here in Austin, we are gearing up for a couple of days hunkered into our homes.
Yes. I know everyone is prepared. Everyone has a little bit of PTSD from last year, but I just want to say this forecast is nowhere near what we had last
year. Nowhere near. As a matter of fact, I have appointments on Friday that I plan to go to.
Yeah, I think tomorrow will be wet and miserable and a little iffy, but I think we'll be back in action on Friday.
My new next door neighbors who have come from the Northeast are asking me, I don't understand what all this hullabaloo is about. I said, it's just something we're not accustomed to, because this kind of weather is what we deal with all the time in places like Chicago and New York, which is places you and I both lived.
Exactly. But, you know, houses are built here also to shed heat, not keep them in. So there's a lot of things. It's roads freezing, asphalt versus
true.
Concrete. There's a lot of elements
We can't laugh from the north that people from down here. We do not have the infrastructure to handle it here in Texas, which, so we're not
just
set for
like the heat.
But
strikes them crazy because they don't have the central heating and air everywhere like we do. Right. So, you know.
But, interestingly enough, in New York City, there were two Broadway openings this week. Or not, sorry. Two Broadway openings.
And I thought there were two.
There were two, and then there was another one that was off-Broadway. But I want to talk about the opening that happened last night, which is very interesting. MJ the Musical opened last night. And it's funny to see
long journey this one has had.
Long journey this one has had. To remind our listeners, this is the MJ the Musical, written by Lynn Nottage, but is sanctioned by the Michael Jackson estate.
Correct.
So it has been relatively controversial as it's gone on through. And then word, when it first started, I wasn't thinking much of it, but then word started saying that it was a really good show. And last night's reviews sort of mirror that, in that it's very funny to see on the Did They Like Us page. There's 15 reviewers, five mm-hmm. loved it, five were middle of the road, and five hated it. So truly, like the quintessential mixed review of this one.
And here's the thing. I think if you are a giant fan of the music or the person or the whole Jackson hullabaloo, then I think you're going to enjoy it no matter what.
Yeah, there are people that really love the show. I think that the biggest critique is that it is a whitewashed version of, not, you know, it's, maybe that's a poor choice of words, but it's a pablumated version of the show, which doesn't show Michael Jackson's life in total. His later troubles are sorely missed, it seems, by a lot of the critics that did not like it. One of those was Jesse Green. But let me just read the first paragraph and a half of his review. For MJ the Musical by Jesse Green. Quote, Michael Jackson was such a magnet for strange stories that they nearly obliterated his gift. Yet in defensively brushing off the ones that don't matter while pointedly ignoring the one that does, the new musical, MJ, which opened on Tuesday at the Neil Simon Theater, may be the strangest Michael Jackson story yet. Not all strangeness is bad, of course, and within the confines of the biographical jukebox genre, MJ, with a book by Lynn Nottage, is actually pretty good for a while. So this piece was also directed and choreographed by Krista Weldon, who is a dancer who directed and choreographed On the Town. No, On the Town?
I think
American
I
in
think
Paris,
that might
excuse
be-
me.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, it was in that era. So... So from what Jesse Green is saying is it was okay for a while, and then after a while it just got too much. The whole piece is around his 1992 Dangerous tour, so it's actually before his troubles in the tabloids and then finally in the law.
He was always in the tabloids.
I'm talking about all the tabloid things about the monkey,
yeah.
the bleached skin, etc. Those things. But yes, he was always in the tabloids. Michael Jackson is played by an actor named Miles Frost, who gets really great notices. He's supposed to.
I was about to say he got some really great notices. What a daunting person to play.
True. True. And he says, and again, I will quote Jesse Green. Frost has him down cold, meaning the portrayal of Michael Jackson. And then he goes on to say, perhaps too cold. Absent any deeper revelation of the singer's character, Frost's performance of the songs soon begins to seem animatronic, as if he were created by Disney Imagineers. And so again, he's saying that he's missing the depth of the Michael Jackson story.
Well, I mean, Michael Jackson did have that whole, what was the thing? He took over at Disney. and you could go see Michael Jackson do his whole thing.
I know. I believe that's probably why he mentioned
that.
So
it's very interesting. It's very interesting too that like the lot of Jacksons this week in the news with Janet Jackson's documentary and this opening, I was like, whoa, Jackson time.
Right. And I just found it very interesting when Lynn Nottage signed on to this. And then in this review, anyway, he says clearly Lynn Nottage had to compromise in her writing of this to miss the depth and breadth of the character. And it says,
I mean, when you're working with an estate and something of the estate of this artist in particular, that can't be an easy task.
Right. She's doing the approved autobiography, which is, which is, you know, I don't know. I have not seen it. I don't know enough about it, but
I don't know either, but I don't either. So, are they trying to tell this whole story or really letting us just embrace the
idea is they're just doing that little clip in time. But but his whole story is there and everybody knows it. So it seems to be purposely leaving that out, which they are. And finally, he says in this MJ is trying to have it both ways. He wants to blame everything sad and weird about Jackson on others, especially the press who are equated with zombies and Thriller, but credit him alone for every good deed and successes. So it's interesting. Other reviewers said Matt Wyndham of AM New York said, depending on one's inclination, MJ can be seen as a slick and lively tribute concert, a by-the-numbers bio jukebox musical, or a defiant public relations effort trying to rebrand and refocus Jackson's image, reputation, and legacy. Did they like it? Juan Michael Porter said, it's hard to blame Lynn Nottage and Christopher Weldon for the Vegas-style cosplay karaoke mash that ensues when it's clear that they were hemmed in by the estate. And Tim Tiemann of the Daily Beast said, this is a slickly corporate, officially sanctioned slice of legacy cleanup. If you want to hear a bunch of Jackson's most famous and not that famous songs stitched together with a colorless lack of plot, roll up. And then Time Out New York.
See, that's what I thought it always was. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess that's why I didn't expect anything more. And I'm like, well, what were you people? Why were you expecting more?
Yep. Time Out New York. Adams Feldman liked it. He said the music and the dancing are sensational. And that isn't the show success really. Isn't that the show suggests really the point at the end? Doesn't that beat all? And finally, Helen Shaw Vulture said, only the music and movement in MJ work. The show's Michael, Miles Frost, glides and hip rocks through a physical impersonation that operates above and beyond the show's ugly logic. So I don't know. Would you go
see them all?
Would you go see it?
I see it.
Would you?
Yeah.
I do have. Go ahead.
I saw the cast. I saw a video of the cast earlier in the week. What was closing? Was it Skeleton Crew closing? I don't remember what was closing across the street from them. But as a goodbye and an
Skeleton Crew just opened.
Oh no, that's right. There's whatever just closed last week because my brain is. Whatcham
Hooja just closed.
And they were across the street.
Passover
from
just
theater.
Closed.
Okay. Well, they went out and they performed Thriller for them. They put the street blocks on either side in front of the theater, and the cast went out and performed Thriller for the other cast and gave them a send off. And I was like, yeah, see, that's some very. There was a lot of talent. You know what I mean? And I guess I enjoyed it.
Well, how strange that Broadway would have a lot of talent.
Yeah, I know. It's shocking, right? What if you're walking down the street and you saw this late cast with this other cast going, woo, and giving a kudos? Like, what a moment. Pretty
they
cool.
also did something interesting that I really liked, that they had four different Playbill covers for opening night.
That was interesting.
Yeah, so, and you can see all those four. We have a link to the Playbill.
I didn't see any missing Playbills like we did with the Sondheim.
True.
Stuff.
It's a whole different thing. If you want to see those four playbills, you can go to offstageonair.com. There's a link to the Playbill article that shows them to you. But that was interesting. The other opening,
that is interesting.
The other opening on Broadway is what you just alluded to, which is Skeleton Crew, which got a great like
slave play. They were across the street. It was for slave.
We
play.
Just said that. I said that, and you said
no.
Yes,
we said Passover, and I
oh,
said
slave play.
I think so, and
Passover.
It was slave play.
Correct. I'm sorry. Okay, so where was I? Nicole Shiro, the queen of the non sequiturs.
Skeleton Crew. We
skeleton,
were going into Skeleton Crew.
Skeleton Crew opened on January 28th. It's playing through February 20th at the Samuel J. Friedman Theater. And it's about an automotive factory that's on the brink of foreclosure, and four workers hang out talking about it. It sounds really amazing. And Felicia Rashad is in this. It is directed.
Love her.
Yeah, I do too.
I love her.
I do as well. And oh my God, why did I just lose the name of the very famous director? And I didn't underline it. I'll find it at some point. This was a Manhattan Theater Club production. It opened a week ago today. As I said, it is played by Felicia Rashad and some others. It looks amazing. It looks good. Did you read any of the other actors, by the way, are Shantae Adams, Joshua Boone, and oh my God, where'd the fourth one go? I got to learn to write to underline.
I was like, names. I knew Shantae Adams, but I don't remember the other people offhand, which is bad.
Well, the last name is Faye, which is one of my things that I have a problem with reviews when they say the full name once and then they say the last names after that, and I keep.
And then you can't
and I can
remember.
If I don't know
I
them.
Know. Who did Ruben direct this? Was this Ruben?
Yes, Ruben Santiago Hudson. Thank you.
Hudson. Yes, I was like a double name. He's got a double name going on in there.
Yeah.
That.
Oh, and actually, okay. So the Faye is the character, and I did want to read the very first paragraph because it's kind of fun. This is written, of course, by Jesse Green. Quote, the construction of the joke is perfect. A 60-ish woman in the grungy break room of a metal stamping factory lights a cigarette beneath a sign that says, no smoking, Faye. The Faye part is added by hand in big, angry letters. Naturally, as we soon learn, she is Faye. And she's played by Dominique Marceau.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Right under the big no smoking sign.
Oh, and there is Ruben Santiago Hudson's name underlined finally. It's in the second to last paragraph. He finally mentions him. But it looks like a
really? They waited to the second to the last paragraph to put that in there.
True. And they wait to the there was a bit. They had these interludes and he says of robot like popping and waving choreographed by and performed by Adesola Asakalumi. Kalumi, I'm sure I didn't pronounce that properly, but he said those were a little bit, those and these projections were a little bit
disjointed,
not disjointed, but they took away from the piece. So they were disjointed in that it didn't seem to fit to him.
Mm-hmm. I'd still want to go see it.
Yeah,
it
looks, I do.
I think it's cool looking.
I do too. So other critics, Matt Weinman of AM New York said, Ruben Santiago Hudson's absorbing production has finally officially opened and was well worth the wait. By the way, it had an off-Broadway run in 2016. Greg Edmonds of Deadline say Skeleton Crew is a play that feels even more pertinent now than it did when it landed in a stellar off-Broadway production back in 2016. The play was terrific then. It is essential now. Did they like it? Juan Michael Porter II said, the play is a spectacular blend of lyrical language, political analysis, and delightful humor that prioritizes black lives and sensibilities over respectability politics. And finally, Anayana Prescott of Variety said, Skeleton Crew presents a vibrant cast, poetic dialogue, and profoundly layered storytelling that moves the audience to audibly engage.
That's cool.
Okay. Oh, we gotta go faster. So the last thing I want to do talk about, the last review I want to talk about is my favorite title. It's called Shh.
What was that?
It's called Shh. And this is performed and directed by the playwright. Who is Claire Barron. Excuse me. They call the show, it is explicit and occasionally uncomfortable, but all for the right reasons. It's very interesting. The set seems pretty cool. And the set was done by Arnulfo Maldonado. And I'll just read this. It says that it makes the space feel as if it were an apartment transformed into a theater rather than the reverse, which I think that's interesting. So it looks like,
yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah. And one thing I think that you will probably appreciate, the whole thing begins with a character named Sally. It is performed by Constance Schulman, and she's recording an ASMR meditation.
Oh.
Because we like that.
You definitely love it.
Yeah, it spends a lot of time talking about the edginess and the rawness of this piece, and it deals with a lot of sexuality, where they describe not necessarily, you know, how someone's feeling or the lead up to, but just the actual acts, the actual sexual acts, and it can be a little bit off-putting.
Isn't it about the effects of like rape culture and sexual assaults and all of these?
Quite frankly, I'm not sure.
Like
I didn't get a good idea of exactly what it says. It says the work itself has the feel of a series of flirtations. Discomfort, assaults, insecurities, and sorrows are spoken about and alluded to, but not detailed. This playwright,
yeah,
by the way,
I remember when this was at in DC before it came to New York. I think it was at the Atlantic Theater Company.
I do not doubt you,
but I remember it was in DC.
This is the same playwright that wrote Dance Nation.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, which Theater Unblocked did a really wonderful production of it here in Austin, Texas. But it seems like something
their marketing was great for that.
It seems like something I would want to go see.
Sounds very interesting.
Yep. Okay.
Plus, it has your AMSR in there, and you like that.
That's it's my ASMR. And then there's a show coming up written by Edie Brickell. It's called 38 Minutes, a new musical about her personal experience living through that 2018 false alarm in Hawaii.
I was like, what a random, I mean, I get it. It's not random, but it's random.
I know, it's kind of random.
There's so many things going on in the world right now. And I'm like, that, okay. But yes, the false missile alerts in Hawaii.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Uh-huh. I want to see how that fills up an entire play, but we'll see. It's happening this month in Los Angeles. There was a 2019 reading of it that was successful. And the cast is led by Carmen Cusack. Who was in Bright Star?
Which I found interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wasn't she also in Kathy Lee Gifford's musical?
I do not know, but I wouldn't be at all surprised. It is directed by Josh Rhodes, but it seems really kind of fun and interesting.
Edie Brickell went to my high school in Dallas.
Well, gosh, look at that. We have to actually go and take a break. So.
Right.
We're going to listen to 2x2 because it is 2-2-2-2-2-2.
2-2-2-2.
Here it is. We'll be back.
2x2, we're marching door to door. Because God loves Mormons and he wants some more. A two-year mission is our sacrifice. We are the army of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. 2x2, and today we'll know.
As COVID-19 continues to spread across Austin-Travis County, Austin Public Health reminds you to protect yourself and your loved ones through vaccines, boosting, and testing. Vaccines and boosters offer the best protection from COVID-19 and its variants,
and tests are available at Austin Public Health sites as well as providers throughout the community. Now is the time to get vaxxed, get boosted, and get tested. Find COVID-19 vaccine locations and testing sites at austintexas.gov/COVID-19.
I don't know whose voice that was, but it was amazing. You there? Okay.
That sounds like Lisa. That sounded like you, Lisa Chef.
There you go.
I hit the mute sometimes when I'm walking with my phone.
I know. Okay, we're running way out of time. There's so much more stuff I wanted to talk about. You can see it offstageonair.com, all the things we want to talk about, specifically Gilded Age, the new
Jonathan Fellows.
Yeah, not Jonathan. Is it Jonathan Fellows or is it?
I don't know.
Somebody Fellows.
Last name's Fellows.
But lots of Broadway people in it. And also, you had sent me an article about the rabbi from Come From Away.
Come From Away.
Very interesting. He refuses to see it, but he is in favor of it.
He says he can't see it.
He can't see it, right.
Religious purposes, correct. Women singing.
Yeah,
but
I'm going to kind of say.
I'm going to kind of. Wife have.
Okay, so we're going to move on just really quickly because we want to make sure we have enough time for our. Entire interview of the second part with Bonnie Cullum. My mind is a little foggy today, but I just want to let folks know what's going on in the city. City Theater on February 10th is having its tribute to Sondheim. Andy Burkowski will be our guest next week, and we'll talk about that. Austin Shakespeare is doing Zui Loico di Cristal. Or what I would like
Lisa,
to...
Lisa, I knew you were going to be excited to say that.
I would like to call it the glass meringue. What do you call it? Meringue.
Menagerie?
No, but that was Nick Squared. Nick Mayo.
Nick Squared.
Had his own version. They will also be on the show next week. And then on December 11th, TexArts is opening up Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street.
Street.
Very, very interesting. Looking forward to all of those. Are you a fan of Sweeney Todd?
Yes, I was like, I do love the Sweeney Todd.
I don't like it. I don't love it. It's not my favorite.
No, it's not my favorite either, but yet I'm like, something draws me to it all the time.
Yeah.
It really kind of disturbs me at the same time.
It's very disturbing.
And yet I'm drawn to it. It's very weird.
It is not, it's the quintessential anti-hero in musical theater. Written by
but it's
one...
like American Psycho. That's another one that's just weird, yet I'm drawn to it.
I'm not drawn to American Psycho, but I definitely... Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. I got the joy of, in its original run on Broadway, being in the theater after hours and on the set of Sweeney Todd. Sort of cool.
Okay, that's like really spectacular.
Yeah, back in the day. So that was just the real quickie I just want to see. The other thing I would like to call people's attention to is another thing you sent me. Dallas Black Theater Alliance is working with Dallas Summer Musicals to stream and perform. I, of course, don't have the article open because I didn't think we were going to have time to read it. Some performances of, I'm looking for it right now. It's directed. It was choreographed by Alvin Ailey, and it's called Odetta. And every student in grade level in the Dallas Independent School District during Black History Month, which is February, will have access to see this thing. So that seems really amazing to me.
Spectacular! I was so excited. I know. I think I was bombarding you with a lot of
good.
But there's some cool stuff going on that made me like warm, fuzzy, and excited inside.
Yep, me too. Okay, let's take another little break, and then we'll come back and hear Bonnie Cullum. Let's listen to Sweeney Todd. Choosing music this week was very easy. This is Pirelli's Miracle Elixir. We'll be right back.
Was okay. Pirelli's miracle elixir, that's what did the trick, sir. True, sir, true. Was it quick, sir? Did it in a tick, sir? Just like an elixir ought to do. How about the fun?
Co-op News Flash number 3, in pursuit of racial justice. Did you know that education in the 21st century has not been the pathway to wealth equality? In 2015, the heads of households of black families who graduated from college had about 33% less wealth than white families whose heads dropped out of high school. At every education level, blacks are 2 times as likely to be unemployed compared to their similarly educated white peers. This is the nature of systemic racism. This message is brought to you by the Co-op Community Council Subcommittee on Systemic Racism. To get involved or for more info, please visit coop.org/racial-justice.
Okay, we have just enough time to introduce our next guest, which is the second part of our piece on longstanding theaters and Bonnie Cullum. I'm very excited about this, Nicole. The second half is really...
the second half is even better than the first?
I think so.
I like it.
I think
that's
so.
Exciting.
Well, we're going to pick up right as Bonnie is talking about moving into the new theater complex. I believe that is where we start. So let's just do it, shall we?
Okay.
Here it is.
Let's do it.
That's not it. Did not get queued up properly. I call that... operator error. Here it is.
How were your audiences back then? You know, in producing theater, it's easier to build an audience which demographically tends to skew white and resourced, like by playing Neil Simon, which is what you were not doing. So how were your audiences reacting to your style of performance? And were you indeed getting audiences to come out to the East Side to see your shows?
Absolutely. We did really well, particularly if we would do something that was cutting edge, had nudity, was political, that had a new technological edge. I feel like those are the shows that sold the very best. And having some of them were scripted and by new playwrights, and some of them were things that we developed in house. But and some of them were pieces that were brought to me by company members. Or, you know, every year Chad would write a new opera. At that time, we were doing kind of one new ethos production a year.
You're saying Chad Salvata, who's
Chad
your
Salvata, yeah. And I would direct it, you know, and his stuff was the weirdest, but it always sold so well. You know, he had a real reputation for stuff that was super weird and super cool. And however that would come out of his head, I would try to manifest the impossible on stage with my really great design team. We would like make this kind of magical world, and people would be like, whoa, what's that? So I feel like we did have a really strong base of young people and theater people and people of color. Then I think that was like our early foundation. I don't know that, you know, I do think that was part of the issue with like attracting donors, was like we weren't really pandering to the donors, and our ticket prices were affordable, and we were doing sliding scales, and we were doing, you know, pay what you can nights, and we were doing deals for people, and we started Radical Rush free tickets to, you know, so we were trying to reach people who maybe thought the theater was inaccessible and unaffordable. And, you know, certainly there is theater like that out there that has a different price point and, you know, that's going to offer you a different experience. But people were really liking what they were getting at the Vortex. And then we got a beer and wine license in 2005. So then it started to become more like you could go to the Vortex and have a different experience, and you could stay afterwards and have a drink and talk with your friends. And I think that's where the community shift really happened, right. when we started that.
I think when I think of the Vortex now and what you've built in that and the theater itself and the company, and I listen to you and hear about the history, it really was a foregone conclusion that you would get to where you are now. But at the time, it must not have felt that way. And I'm wondering, when you moved into that space on the East Side, which is now a theater hub for the city of Austin or for the theater community in Austin, could you have, did you envision what it would be now back then?
This is a classic case of be careful what you ask for. I had done this really powerful magical ritual to find the Vortex. I had invited a bunch of people over to the old Vortex, and we had done this working to like find the right space, to find a space that could be home. Now, this is the moment that I really should have packed up and moved away and just like not done this anymore. And in my magical working, I saw this vision of this garden with lights strung across it and people eating and drinking and having this community thing. And so when we got that property with that big yard, I was like, and at that time the yard still had grass, you know, it was like, it was kind of an overgrown, had been a workspace, but it had been abandoned for 10 years. So, you know, there was grass and poison ivy and, you know, it was just kind of like a wild space. And my father was like, well, you should just pave it and make it into a parking lot. And I was like, I don't think that's what its destiny is. I think that it needs to be this outdoor gathering space that people can come and just hang out. And then hopefully that makes them want to go to the theater. That we can, you know, because I can't necessarily get them into the theater, but I think that I can make a space that people can hang out, and then we can maybe teach them that there's theater going on and maybe they'll come to it. So, you know, it was my sort of thought that it would be this community destination, but it took so many years to get it there. You know, it was like this huge, hard thing. And, you know, I tried to get the beer and wine license and TABC denied me, and I had to get the property rezoned in order to get the beer and wine license. I mean, this took years. It was like absolutely impossible. And I can't tell you how many times I hit the wall going, this is never going to happen. I'm just not going to get there. It was not a foregone conclusion. And then the property owner decided he was going to sell the property in 1998 and put for sale signs out front and cut down the trees and didn't tell us that this was going to happen. So it was, you know, it was very hard. It was very stressful. My father came in and helped and was able to form a little family LLC that purchased the property from that guy so that he could put that money into his other properties, because, you know, I was just going to continue to be a thorn in his side, as my father put it. So that was really lucky, and that happened in 99 before things started exploding in Austin. You know, that we kind of crested in right under the wire of East Side development and acceleration of that development, which again, really in terms of Manor Road, didn't start until 2012, 2013. Right. So, you know, it's been fairly recent in terms of this, like, our longevity there.
Very fast recently. And, you know, I do remember when I came in and opened my first theater, you and I met right at that point and talked outside in the unimproved area, which is now a thriving social spot for all of Austin, not just the theater community. And there were just a handful of theaters in Austin at that time. There continues to be just a handful of theaters, right. But most were followed you to the East, or many followed you to the East Side. At that time, there was Arts on Real. There was your place.
Salvage Vanguard and
Salvage Vanguard and the Off Center. And then came City Theater, Play Theater Group there for a while. So the East Side became the place for theater, and probably has you to thank for it. Yep. So Take the compliment. You got it.
I'm glad I could help.
You did a great job. Well, I'm constantly impressed, and I think that has a lot to do with the way you your vision of the company itself and the way you work with people. As I mentioned in 2004 when I just came here looking to fold my way into the theater community, you were one of the few people that opened your arms to me. So that I think says a lot about where and how you got to where you are. I want to talk a little bit about the structure of the theater company itself. Have you always had company members? Like members of a company of actors, or was that something that was more in your later history?
No, it started very early on. And in fact, when we were still at the old Vortex, I tried to really formalize everything. I made a whole bunch of company positions. There was going to be a company manager. There was kind of an executive committee that was going to meet with me. There was going to be somebody that helped with box office and somebody that was helping with publicity. And there was a lot of dissemination of responsibilities and people kind of taking ownership of different parts that didn't really work out very well. We were all like in our 20s and we were just kind of scrapping at it, trying to figure out what we were doing. And, I think ultimately that sort of shifting away from trying to get the artists to do the nuts and bolts work, it wasn't very helpful. There were a few people who could really do it and everybody else was like, I'm sorry, what am I doing?
Yeah.
And I think sort of as we moved to the new Vortex, shifting to that artist cultivation model where we were doing workshops and doing new plays and working on, sort of doing readings and changing the model a little bit to put the artists and in their true, strength at bringing these pieces forward. That seemed to be a better use of people's energies. And I did have a robust manager on duty system for years where I could get these fabulous volunteers. Like I had people who would always do Thursday night and I had people who would always do Friday night, and they would basically run the concessions and help me with the box office and make it so that I didn't have to be there every night.
Right.
And so that was on for years, because it, like I said, it was just me and some work study students that were kind of holding the admin together. I didn't have a managing director for any of those early years at all. And in fact, after I did have a managing director, it was more of a kind of part-time help situation. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even really what it is now, So that shift has been super important. And being able to hire staff, it started with really moving to a different model with hiring Melissa and rehiring Crystal. Crystal had been my work study student for a number of years.
Oh.
And she had worked with me administratively, and then she'd gone to grad school in, she's an archaeologist. So she'd gone off to grad
school. Right. I did not know that.
Yeah. She'd gone off to grad school and gotten her archaeology degree. And I thought she'd go off and be a teacher somewhere or something. But when she graduated, she called me up and said, I want to move back to Austin and come back to work at the Vortex. And I was like, yes, please. So getting Crystal back, and first Melissa, who I'd worked with as an actor for many years, and we were very, very good friends, but she also was working a job that she hated. And she was hearing me complain all the time about how I didn't have enough help, and I was really struggling with this, and really, if only I had a... So one day she's like, okay, so what if it was me? And I'm like, well, sure, temporarily. And she's like, no, not temporarily, like for real. So she came on and, we started working towards all the things that I was really wanting, but I didn't really have enough capacity to do. And then we got Crystal back, and I feel like that particular three-legged stool was the thing that was able to launch us really to the next phase. Not to mention the butterfly bar. Crystal was still working for the Vortex in 2011 when we started changing it to the butterfly bar. And I remember Crystal was like helping with the painting and the walls, and you know, she was doing hands-on work to get a to get that bar turned around to be a destination place. And you know, it's so funny because I can remember like when I first, like, I didn't have the money to finish out that room. We did it piece by piece. That when we moved into that building, it was an open, the Butterfly Bar was an open lean-to with no walls.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was not. It was not a room. It was like a shed on the end of the building. So, you know, again, it didn't have air conditioning. It didn't have lighting. It didn't have walls. It was just a metal lean-to. And so we didn't start putting that together. I guess it was in 2002 that my dad got that bar renovated for us. And that bar was from the old Landing, which was his jazz club on the Riverwalk. And so once we got the bar, then we had the showpiece, but we still had no air conditioning and we still, you know, we still had no lighting, right? We were still using clamp lamps in the bar. So and we had no coolers. We were using ice chests. So I'm just saying, you know, it was a little, it was not a nice, smooth, even transition from where we were to where we are. It was very, you know, piecemeal and staggered. And so when the Butterfly Bar came in 2011 and kind of became more of a destination, again, that took a few years to really take off. It wasn't until Patrizzi's came in 2013, and that's when Haymaker came in across the street, and that's when Schoolhouse opened that same year. So in 2013, everything exploded, and I had Melissa and Crystal there helping me, and it just like the business just went, you know, it was like, whoa. And we were able to then shortly thereafter hire Alex to run the box office. I remember telling Alex, I don't have a job for you. You know, you should not give up your day job. He says, I've already given notice. Oh, I'm like, what?
No pressure.
So I was like, okay, I can give you work for 2 weeks. And then he never left. So... Everybody needs an Alex Cogburn, I have to say. There's nothing.
He's
like
amazing. Your entire staff is amazing. So today, what does it mean to be a company member of the Vortex Rep?
That's really hard, Lisa, because of the pandemdem.
Let's take the pandemic out of the. So let's go back to 2019 and do that.
I think that you get some priority of consideration if you have a project that you want to do or move forward. You get some priority of consideration on design and tech positions or acting positions. It's not really a guarantee, but it's definitely a strong consideration. Company meetings, company events, company parties, which allow people not only to connect but to have input. We, you know, a few years ago really jammed on what are our short-term goals, what are our medium-term goals, and what are our long-term goals. And, you know, we're plugging away on that. You know, it's like, it's none of it's easy. And the stuff that the company brings up and the establishing of more equity in the company and bringing more pay to the artists, these are all things that we have been doing. But it is, you know, this has been slow in coming, and admittedly, you know, some people come in with great enthusiasm and never leave, and some people come in with great enthusiasm and then move on to other things. And sure. I think that's just the nature of any group. And, you know, the real heartwarming stuff are the, you know, the love relationships that people have had at the Vortex that have ended up with marriage and children and, you know, people who've met at the Vortex that have had life-changing experiences. I think, you know, people whose ashes are now in the garden. I think that these are the things that are the most meaningful on the human level, and that when we have gotten together as a company, even early on in the pandemic, I haven't done it a lot because it's been very emotional, but we did have a nice Zoom meeting and a lot of people showed up and there were some tears and, you know, it was hard. It was just, it's hard not being together and it's hard not working together. So things have been tough for everybody, I think. I did invite a bunch of new people to come in during the pandemic because I wanted just I was thinking about honing the company down to a very small number and just really focusing on a small group of artists. But instead, I threw the door open and just invited everybody to the table because, you know, it seemed like we needed each other so badly and that we couldn't really connect in the normal ways that we do as theater artists. And the reason that we're theater artists is because we like to work in groups. Yeah. You know, it's just been very difficult. So we're crawling along, doing some things, you know, moving back towards something. I don't know what it looks like in the long run, but, you know, we're continuing forward.
Well, that was going to be my next question in terms of the long run. What's your vision for the Vortex moving forward? And I know the pandemic has really changed things. I think they've changed things moving forward. It'd be different if this didn't happen. But where do you see the Vortex? What do you want for the Vortex in the future?
Well, it's multifaceted. I think improving the facility is a really important piece. We don't have enough space for anything. We're out of office space. We're out of storage space. We're out of costume storage. We're out of prop storage. We have no space for anything. It's all full. Everything's full. Bar storage is a disaster. You know, it's just we were not built for the volume of business that we are doing. So that has to be addressed. We need some major renovations. And so we're going to be looking at probably a capital campaign and rebuilding the restrooms to be gender neutral and more accessible. They are not up to, you know, they aren't where I want them to be, and they haven't been ever. So it's one of those things that just has to happen, and we have to do it correctly. And then Nick and I are working on a new building that would house Patrizzi's kitchen. It wouldn't really be an indoor sit-down restaurant, but right now it takes him 3 trucks to do one day's worth of food.
Wow!
So if he had a commissary kitchen, he could operate so much better, more efficiently. We could be open earlier. We could do more. And then that building would also have the rehearsal room and the costume storage that I so desperately need. So I think Nick and I will be working on that. He's already got the plans for it, and it just looks amazing. So I think over the next few years, there's going to be a lot of facility improvements to bring us to the place of the size and scope of organization that we are and the number of employees that we have. So that'll be like a catch-up kind of thing. Bringing more benefits and more money to existing staff and then trying to fill positions that feel overwhelmingly full with additional people, whether that's an assistant or splitting up some of the work so that there's more people. Like, you know, it's always a joke when we go to these theater conferences and they're like, well, just let your marketing department handle that. You know? Like, oh, right, our marketing department, you know. But I think that we'll be looking at how to strategically create structure within the organization that can hold the work that we're doing. Right now, you know, kind of coming from doing nothing in the pandemic in terms of live, moving back to live has been a real strain on the existing staff. And I can see that not only myself, but everybody is just working too hard. And so, you know, my remedy to that is to have more people on staff who can take some of that work. So I'm hoping over the next few years to really see an increase in artistic staff and production staff. And then, you know, actually maybe, I don't know if we'll ever have a marketing department, but something that looks like a marketing department.
What about artistically? Where do you see Vortex going creatively?
Well, we've been doing a lot of new work that is created by artists that we know who have, you know, been finding their voices and writing new plays. And I'm very excited about the new work that's been generated during the pandemic. And I'm hoping to be able to produce a lot of that new work. I'm interested in moving us towards a green new theater. And I see the future of theater with climate crisis, that theater needs to find a new place in the world to not only be a place that makes art, but transforms culture and creates an environment where we can more closely look at our collective response to climate crisis and the way that we as artists can contribute to solutions. And, you know, that's not only in the way that we make the theater, but in the resources that it takes, but also the kind of content that we're offering to audiences and the information about the way that theater can be more than just a stage. It's not just a stage. It's a place of humanity that people come together. And that's going to be, I feel that that's going to be more and more important for the rest of my life. I will certainly be working towards, you know, the great turning of the earth from industrial society to a life-sustaining civilization, because if we don't work towards that, then there's no future. So I do think that it's important that theater be forward-looking and thinking about what kind of space we can be for the public, for the artists, you know, nurturing community, nurturing humanity, finding a way forward together. And I'm hoping that years from now, the Vortex will still be a place that people think about coming when bad stuff happens in the world, that we can come together and, you know, share common space and have some food and drink and see a show and talk about it. And whether that's to be uplifted or to be educated or to share sorrow, I think that these are things that the theater can provide. And I'm going to be working towards next year is our 35th season, our choral season.
Amazing.
And I'm going to work for a Green New Theater symposium that I'm going to put together with different people around the country, but also hopefully people in academia here in Austin who would be interested in climate science and also the humanity of theater. I think that's super important.
Well, I love it. And certainly the humanity of theater for its entire existence from the caveman days till now, that's actually been the core of what theater is. It's storytelling and it's connecting with people. Bonnie Cullum, I mean, there's so much more that we could talk about and so much more I would like to talk about, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you.
And telling us about the Vortex. It's amazing.
It was really good to see you and talk with you.
Well, that is it for my interview with Bonnie Cullum and the Vortex and our continuing series on theaters in Austin that have been around for a long time. I could have spent a lot more time talking to Bonnie in detail, and perhaps we'll revisit the Vortex again by talking to some of their older founders or some of the board members, and maybe Rudy Ramirez would come on and talk to us, who's one of the co-artistic directors for quite a while. So it was really good. Our next theater that we're going to be talking to is Ken Webster of Hyde Park. We'll get the history of Hyde Park Theater, which has been around for a long, 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 long time. And there it is. You have it. You spent an hour with me and Nicole and Bonnie Cullum. And you can find links to everything we talked about at offstageonair.com. And then you can also, what was I going to say? You can like us on Facebook and all that stuff. That's always stuff that we like to have here at Offstage and on the Air. Texas Music Mixtape is up next with DJ Mark. Once again, he's here chomping in the bit, trying to get me away from the microphone, but it's really hard to do. I like the microphone. But we will go out for our final song, listening, keeping into themes of the day, because it's Groundhog Day. Let's listen to Punxsutawney Rock from Groundhog Day. We'll see you next week when we look at what's happening offstage and on the air. Stand by for DJ Mark.